particularly in the city proper. Baltimore City was now averaging over 300 murders a year, making it one of the per capita deadliest cities in America. Police officers were consistently trying to solve gun crimes, drug-related crimes, domestic abuse crimes, and robberies. But this case was different, more personal to the cops assigned to it. Not only did it take place outside Baltimore City, in the county, an area where vicious murders were less common, but this shooting involved one of their own. All hands will be on deck to make sure that the perpetrators were brought to justice. The first major lead in the case came a day after the shooting. One of the suspects called a notorious drug dealer to offer him a chance to buy some stolen watches. The drug dealer had an authorized wiretap on his phone, and as a result, the police got a search warrant and went to the house where the call originated. When they found one of the stolen watches under a seat cushion, they suspected they had their man. He later confessed to being in on the robbery, but denied that he had pulled the trigger. Through his interviews, the police identified the other three men, where they lived, and more details about the crime. A day later, another member of the crew was captured. He also confessed to being at the scene, but said that he was not the one who pulled the trigger. In fact, he was later quoted as saying, "I was actually unarmed. I was just told I could make $50,000 to break some glass." This wasn't the first trip through the criminal justice system for either of the men. Both men, in their early 20s, had long criminal records that included drug charges, handgun violations, and assault charges. One of them had been charged a year before with two counts of first-degree murder for separate shootings in West Baltimore. Mary was riveted as she listened to the reporter's dry voice. It was an audacious crime, a troubling sign of the violence that felt like it was closing in on her no matter how far she moved away from the center of the city. Her phone started to ring. Again, she ignored it. Then the reporter described the final two suspects. The reporter warned those watching that they should be assumed to be armed and very dangerous. Mary's large screen television was now filled with photos of these suspects. Her heart broke when she saw Tony's and Wes's faces staring back at her. Midnight passed, and one day turned to the next. Mary could not sleep. She felt terrible about the death of the police officer. She prayed her sons were not responsible. As she lay in bed, she realized that, no matter what the outcome, all of their lives had changed forever. Mary knew it was just a matter of time before she would become the target of questioning. She had not spoken to Wes or Tony for days, but after hearing the news, she wanted to speak to them just as much as she was sure the police did. At 4 a.m., Mary heard a loud banging on her metal front door. "Police, open this door!" She threw on a blue robe, yelling that she was on her way. She could tell from the increasingly frantic banging that the police were seconds away from coming in, with or without an invitation. She cracked open the door, her right eye peering out to see who was waiting. She looked past the stocky man in plain clothes and saw 10, maybe more, cops lined up behind him. A few wore uniforms, more were wearing plain clothes. All were tense. Some had their weapons raised, some had them holstered, their hands ready to snap the guns loose at a moment's notice. Only a thin, hollow metal door stood between her and them. The plainclothesman in front of her flashed a badge, showed a search warrant, and brusquely asked Mary for permission to enter. She took a step back, and as soon as she did, the door swung open and the officers flooded into her home. With weapons drawn, teams split up and searched for Wes, Tony, or any evidence that they had been there recently. One of the officers escorted Mary out of the house and sat her on the stairs outside. She hugged herself as the cold February air blew through her cotton bathrobe. Before long, an officer appeared before her and unleashed a barrage of sternly delivered questions. But Mary could only keep repeating the truth. She had no idea where the boys were and had not seen them in weeks. "Did you know that both your sons are on probation?" "Yes, I did." "Tony is supposed to be on home detention for a drug conviction, and Wesley is still on probation for drug charges from a few years ago." "I know what they're on probation for, officer." "If you knew where they were, would you tell us?" Mary finally snapped at them. "Look, I just found out that my sons are wanted for killing a police officer. If I find anything out, I will tell you, and I will cooperate however I can. But right now, I don't need to be questioned like I did something wrong." The questions and searching of the house continued for the next hour. The jarring percussion of drawers being opened and closed, dressers being shifted around, and beds being flipped over rattled through the quiet night and shook Mary's nerves. Black, spit-shine police shoes with hard rubber soles cracked down on every inch of hardwood floor. Mary sat on the outdoor concrete steps with the officer standing over her, the two mirroring each other's despair and frustration. The first rays of morning lit up the still deserted streets of Dundalk, Maryland, where Mary's new home was located, as the cops mounted up to leave her ransacked space. Every crevice had been inspected. Every room had been searched. Every secret, presumably, uncovered. The police departed with a threat. They would be back and would not leave her alone until they found Tony and Wes. To nobody's surprise, they were true to their word. The search for the Moores had just begun. 2 days after that first early morning visit, Mary's niece, Niecy's daughter, was moments from walking down the aisle for her wedding. As a recording of Here Comes the Bride played over the loudspeaker in the Northeast Baltimore church, the rear doors opened and the veiled bride began her slow procession toward the altar. She walked alone down the aisle as the well-wishers in the pews stood and smiled. Tony was supposed to walk arm in arm with his cousin and give her away. Her father had never been involved in her life. Her unescorted stroll down the aisle was a subtle reminder that the manhunt for two of Maryland's most wanted was still on, now in day 5. The family had been bombarded with interview requests, police questioning, and neighborhood stares. Both city and county police had been crisscrossing their jurisdictions, looking for any sign of Wes and Tony. The police conducted a raid of the Circle Terrace apartments in Lansdowne, where Tony lived. Acting on a tip, they combed the North Point neighborhood in Baltimore. A team of officers went by Wes's current address, on the 2700 block of Calvert Street in the city, on the outskirts of Johns Hopkins University, close enough that Wes could see and hear the construction slowly creeping in around him. The police plastered the neighborhood with wanted posters, advertising a sizable reward. In the evenings, a police chopper with searchlights flew over the Essex community, where Wes had lived a few years earlier. The wedding was a reprieve for the family. This celebration was the first time in days that they could simply enjoy one another's company without the events of February 7th dominating the conversation. Today was supposed to be about joy and love. Following the ceremony, the doors to the church opened to a clear and cool winter day. 100 or so people slowly filed into the street. The snow that had fallen a few days earlier was now a dark slush shoveled against the sides of the road. All of the attendees loaded into their vehicles and set off for the reception hall 10 minutes away. Each driver put on hazard lights as a slow convoy snaked its way to Southeast Baltimore. Two of the vehicles, the ones carrying the 8 members of the wedding party, decided to break from the pack and take a quick detour to a 7-Eleven on the Alameda, a main artery in Baltimore City. They wanted to grab a few sodas and some bags of chips before the reception, just in case it took a while for the food to show up after they arrived. A block away from the store, an unmarked police car pulled up behind the vehicles, red and blue lights flashing. The same car had been sitting outside the church, its occupants observing the celebratory congregants as they walked out. The wedding party pulled over. Doors slammed, and three policemen leaped out of the car and walked up to the wedding party's vehicles. They forced all 8 of the passengers from the vehicles and ordered them to sit on the curb of the traffic island that split Alameda. The men, wearing their white tuxedos, and the women, wearing their silky silver spaghetti strap dresses, complained about having to sit on the slushy curb in their wedding outfits. They were told that they would have to sit down or be arrested. And then one of the officers addressed the group. "Y'all know there's a reward for Tony and Wes if you just tell us where they are. It's a lot of money. You sure you don't need that money? This would be much easier on you if you would just say where those two are." The 8 sat silently, shivering in their now soaked clothes, while the police continued to grill them. It had been more than 30 minutes since they were pulled over. No information had been collected. Not a single idea about the whereabouts of Tony and Wes had been divulged. The wedding party simply sat on the ground, late for the reception, and by now, tremendously agitated. The police, circling the party, felt much the same way. Finally, the officers ordered them back into their cars, but not before placing handcuffs on one of the drivers because he didn't have the proper registration for the rental car they were driving. The rest of the wedding party yelled at the officers as they placed their friend in the back of the cruiser. The arresting officer simply looked back at the group and said, "Enjoy the reception. I hope y'all remember where Tony Moore and Wes Moore are. Quickly." Wes was walking down a street, a Philly cheesesteak in one hand and a new pair of blue jeans in the other. His brother was by his side. 30 feet away, at the corner, he noticed a police cruiser. As he got closer, he noticed that the engine was running and that the two cops inside were murmuring into their walkie-talkies. This was the same squad car Wes had noticed twice earlier in the day, in different parts of the city, but always within 50 feet of where he and Tony stood. But no one had made a move for them, so Wes had chalked it up as simple coincidence. He and Tony continued to move through the crowded Germantown streets towards his uncle's house in North Philadelphia. The crime-ridden neighborhood was where Tony and Wes had escaped just days after the murder. North Philadelphia reminded Wes of the Baltimore neighborhood he had just left. The check-cashing stores instead of banks, the rows of beauty salons, liquor stores, laundromats, funeral homes, and the graffiti-laced walls were the universal streetscape of poverty. The hood was the hood, no matter what city you were in. But just blocks away from their uncle's house, scattered evidence of gentrification, driven by the looming presence of Temple University, had started to manifest. Their uncle's block, where half of the homes sat abandoned and burnt out, represented what the neighborhood had become. Blocks away, where newly built mixed-income homes sat next to picturesque buildings like the Gothic Church of the Advocate, built in 1887, was the direction the neighborhood wanted to go. But even that dynamic wasn't unique. The same thing was happening in West's neighborhood, where Hopkins was a driving force of change, aimed at improving the quality of life for students and faculty. Wes wondered where people like him were supposed to go, once they'd been priced out of the old neighborhoods, once the land changed hands right under their feet. When they got back to the house, Wes went upstairs to the room that housed the bunk bed he and Tony shared. Tupac's "Keep Your Head Up" was on the radio, and Wes turned it up. It was one of his favorites. Pac's voice defiant over the melancholy chorus sampled from the five stair steps. "Ooh, child. Things are gonna get easier." Wes sat down on the bed and opened the plastic bag that held his cheesesteak. The grease leaked from the packaging, and the aroma of the cheese whiz and grilled onions rose from the puncture in the aluminum foil. Wes had just raised the sandwich to his mouth when Tony walked into the room. "I gotta run out for a second. I'll be back." Wes just nodded, distracted by the cheesesteak. Under the beats from the radio, he could hear Tony's white Air Jordans pounding down the stairs. It was mid-afternoon, so most of the lights in the house were off. The room was filled with shadows and the soft glow of natural sunlight. Wes heard Tony yell back up the stairs, "I'll be back, yo!" And then the sound of the front door creaking open. His uncle was always telling them to close the door behind them to keep the cold air outside and the warm air inside. When Wes didn't hear the door close behind Tony, he took one final bite and ran down the stairs to slam it shut. As Wes hit the final stair, he looked up and saw his brother lying face down on the floor, a police officer's knee in his back, handcuffs being tightened around his wrists. Before Wes could even react, a half dozen plainclothes officers were on top of him, the barrels of their guns trained on his head, and the lights from the flashlights blinding him. "Don't move! Get your hands in the air!" The officers were now screaming orders to the Moore brothers, telling them to get on the ground and keep their mouths shut. A task force of over 24 Philadelphia police officers, Baltimore City and county police officers, and ATF and FBI officials flooded their uncle's narrow three-story row house. Within minutes of receiving word that the Moore brothers were back in the house, police had cordoned off the entire block. Outside the cordon, curious onlookers were kept away by Philadelphia police officers as Wes and Tony were led outside in handcuffs and thrown into the back of a police wagon. The 12-day manhunt was over. Word spread quickly through the Baltimore City and County Police Departments about the arrest. On the dispatch, a message scrolled across the top of the message board. February 19th, 2000. Dundalk Dispatch advised that both of the Moore brothers are under arrest in Philadelphia. Cheering responses flowed in. Their colleagues had been killed just days earlier. They now believe that the four people responsible were in their custody. The newspapers and television networks ran nonstop coverage of the arrest. civic leaders held press conferences praising the work of the police officers. The county executive of Baltimore County helped lead a telethon that raised money for the widow of Sergeant Prothero and his children. As word spread, a collective sigh of relief seeped through Baltimore's brisk winter air. At home, Mary wept. Wes sat still on the ancient wooden chair. His fingers were entwined, resting on the table in front of him. His nervousness had subsided months earlier. He knew he no longer had control over his destiny. A year had passed since the Prothero shooting, and Wes was the fourth and final defendant to find out his verdict. It had also been a year since the governor of Pennsylvania had agreed to extradite Wes to his home state of Maryland to await trial. Wes was now waiting to find out how the jury of his peers had ruled. The foreman stood up, looking briefly at Wes, and then his eyes darted over to the people in the viewing area of the courtroom. Tony and the other two defendants had all been found guilty and sentenced to life in prison without parole. Tony was charged as the shooter and had avoided a possible death sentence by pleading guilty to felony murder. Unlike the other three defendants, Wes had decided to take his case to trial. He insisted that he was not there the day of the murder. 25 witnesses were called, 60 exhibits were displayed, store security videotapes were shown, and photos were employed by both sides. Wes's lawyer pleaded that the biggest mistake his client made was going to Philadelphia with his brother. His lawyer argued that when Wes was questioned by Baltimore police the day after the crime, before he was announced as a suspect, he was calm, a clear sign of his innocence. His lawyer claimed the police were harassing people in the neighborhood, trying to drum up shaky evidence and confessions. He also pointed out that Wes had converted to Islam in jail and was a father of four children, whom he talked to almost every day on the telephone from jail. The prosecution cast suspicions on Wes's argument that he'd taken a trip to Philadelphia without asking his brother what he was on the run for. A saleswoman at the jewelry store testified that she recognized Wes as one of the four men who'd robbed the store. Also, a necklace was found at the scene of the crime that had Wes's DNA on it. The prosecution claimed it was the calling card they were looking for to prove Wes was there. Wes's attorney argued that Tony must have borrowed the necklace earlier, and it had accidentally dropped out of his pocket at the store. There's only one explanation. It came out of a pocket. It came out of the pocket of that jacket, Wes's lawyer proclaimed. Wes was moments away from finding out which story the jury would believe. Please rise, the bailiff requested. Instructions were ordered. Wes peered over at the jury, six men and six women. They had deliberated for 3 hours. He looked at each of their faces in turn. No one looked back at him. He felt very alone. He sighed deeply. A sudden apathy sapped him. He knew what the foreman had to say before he even parted his lips. Wes stared straight ahead. He was as still as a soldier on parade awaiting his next command. As he heard the foreman begin, he closed his eyes and leaned his head back. On the charge of first-degree felony murder, the jury finds the defendant guilty. Wes stood quietly, his face set, as the foreman read out 10 other charges, all with the same verdict. Wes's consciousness left the scene. He had spent the past year sitting in a cell waiting for this day. With the knowledge of the sentences his brother and the other two defendants had received, he had known his fate would be the same. He would spend the rest of his life in prison. The widow of Sergeant Prothero hugged her father and sobbed. She had sat in the pews of different courtrooms for months, and the emotion of watching the sentencing of the final defendant in the slaying of her husband was overwhelming. About 10 feet away, Wes's mother, Aunt Niecy, and Alicia sat stunned with tears in their eyes as well. A large guard made his way over to Wes, who slowly put his hands behind his back. He kept his head and eyes fixed on the front of the courtroom, never once looking behind him to see the family of the police officer or even his own family. He winced as the cuffs closed around his wrists and the officer began to walk him out of the room. It would be over a month before Wes was in a courtroom again. On that day, he would stand before a judge and hear his fate. You committed an act like something out of the Wild West, and you didn't even realize how outrageous it was, the judge said. That makes you a very dangerous person. The sentence was indeed life in prison without the possibility of parole. The guards placed their hands on Wes and shuffled him away. The hands of the state would stay on him for the rest of his life. Wes had spent much of his adolescence incarcerated, and he knew that occasional bids in the pen were part of the game. But he never figured this. Maybe it was because he never thought long-term about his life at all. Early losses condition you to believe that short-term plans are always smarter. Now Wes's mind wandered to the long-term for the first time. Finally, he could see his future. Wes, the mayor will see you now. As I began walking towards the mayor's mahogany door, I instinctively stuck my hands in my pockets and pushed down, trying to get the cuffs of my pants lower so my high waters might brush the tops of my shoes. For close to a decade, I dressed in a uniform every day. Fashion was not my forte. This was my best blue suit, but because I owned it since high school, it was no longer much of a fit. "Hey, General, how's everything going?" Mayor Schmoke said as I cautiously entered and shook his hand. General was his nickname for me, poking fun at the fact that I was a brand new second lieutenant in the Army Reserve, which, by the way, is as far from a general as an officer can get. Despite my being on my second internship with him and seeing him every day, the mayor still intimidated me. Every time I stepped into his office, I felt the need to genuflect. Even his famously toothy grin failed to put me at ease. Kurt Schmoke had been the mayor of Baltimore for 12 years. The former boy wonder was now a seasoned and slightly cynical leader of the city he called home his entire life. Progress had been made under his leadership. Baltimore had been named an empowerment zone by President Clinton in 1994. On his orders, and with the help of 375 pounds of explosives, the buildings of Murphy Homes were brought down in 20 seconds and soon replaced with mixed-income housing. But his frustration at the glacial pace of change in his city had worn on him. He needed to attend fundraiser after fundraiser just to remain a viable candidate for public office. The problems he'd warned of and prioritized over a decade earlier were persistently difficult to solve. The murder rate had not fallen under 300 in years. Sexually transmitted diseases throughout Baltimore had risen sharply, alongside the teen pregnancy rate. The young, photogenic Yale, Oxford, and Harvard-educated lawyer had learned just how confounding the problems of urban America were. Of course, to talk about the negative sections and aspects of Baltimore without talking about its strengths, its history, and its opportunities would be inaccurate. Baltimore is the birthplace of Babe Ruth and Thurgood Marshall, Edgar Allan Poe and Billie Holiday. The Battle of Baltimore was one of the deciding battles of the War of 1812, and Francis Scott Key, a lawyer and native Baltimorean, penned the Star-Spangled Banner at Fort McHenry while watching soldiers from our new nation fight off the British. Baltimore's home of the B&O Railroad and the best crab cakes anywhere. West Baltimore was one of the intellectual capitals of the East Coast in the early 20th century. At the same time, to simply walk along the pristine Inner Harbor or go see the Orioles in action without understanding that all of Baltimore is not downtown would be equally misleading. The truth is that there are two Baltimores. Almost every major city in this country leads the same double life. Those who brag about Baltimore often ignore these substandard areas. Yet these were the areas Mayor Schmoke knew would determine his legacy of success or failure. He asked me to take a seat on the couch. I found his office imposing when I first saw it, but its quiet elegance had, over time, made the stronger impression. Plaques and awards lined the walls, along with photos of the mayor with presidents, prime ministers, and everyday Baltimoreans. The office reflected the man, hugely impressive and unassuming at once. His waistline had grown slightly over the years. His suspenders now pulled his pants above his beltline. In the final year of his third term and preparing to retire, he was leaving not because of term limits, but because of fatigue. He could have easily won a fourth term had he wanted it, but he didn't. What he wanted now was to spend time with his family and for someone else to grab hold of the reins of the city he loved with its daunting array of problems. Mayor Schmoke eased into the chair across from the couch. He leaned back, rubbing both hands over his thinning hair, now salted with gray, and asked me how I had enjoyed my internship. I offered a crisp response. "I've loved it, sir." But my glib answer didn't do justice to the impact the time in his office had had on me. I didn't know how to begin to express my gratitude. I had returned to Baltimore 2 years earlier, after I'd been accepted at Johns Hopkins University to complete my undergraduate degree, which I'd begun in junior college at Valley Forge. One afternoon at Valley Forge, I was talking to my college advisor about what to do after I received my associate's degree. My advisor told me that she knew the assistant director of admissions at Johns Hopkins, who she wanted me to meet. My mother had been working in Baltimore for the past 5 years, and I considered Baltimore home, so I knew about Johns Hopkins. I just didn't know anyone who went there. My perception of Hopkins was as a distant force in the neighborhood, a research university responsible for some of the greatest medical gifts the world has ever received, but that had very little to do with the life of the city I knew. Hopkins was also full of kids who did not look or sound like me. "Ma'am, I don't want to be a doctor," I quickly answered her. "Wes, it's much more than that. Just have lunch with them. At the very least, I think you'll enjoy each other's company." A week later, I sat across the table from Paul White, the assistant director of admissions at Johns Hopkins. I was expecting a stodgy older gentleman who'd offer me canned encomiums about Hopkins and then stiffen and ask for the check when he found out the details of my standardized test scores. What I found was a black man with a warm disposition and a booming voice, who bristled with energy and was constantly in motion, his hands swooping like birds in flight to accentuate his points. I spent much of the lunch telling him my story, and he spent the remaining time selling me on Hopkins. By the end of our meal, I realized that Hopkins represented much more than a chance to attend a great school with a phenomenal reputation. It was also a chance to go home. My relationship with my mother had changed significantly. I had spent so much of my life running from her, trying to show her that I didn't need her as much as she thought. She spent much of the same period being an unrelenting disciplinarian. But as I got older, and as she realized her days of hardcore parenting were coming to an end, she became more than a mother. She became a friend. But there was still the matter of getting in. My SAT scores were hundreds of points below the average for students entering Johns Hopkins. And despite my being a junior college graduate and an Army officer, I knew that landing admission at Hopkins would be a stretch at best. So after filling out the application, I put it out of my mind. But months later, I got the large package in the mail. Not only was I accepted, but I would receive scholarship money. I read the letter aloud to my mother over the phone, and she screamed in excitement. While reading the letter, I thought about Paul White. Having an advocate on the inside, someone who'd gotten to know me and understood my story on a personal level, had obviously helped. It made me think deeply about the way privilege and preference work in the world, and how many kids who didn't have luck like mine in this instance would find themselves forever outside the ring of power and prestige. So many opportunities in this country are apportioned in this arbitrary and miserly way, distributed to those who already have the benefit of a privileged legacy. Many of the kids I grew up with in the Bronx, including guys like Shay, who stayed outside the law, never believed that they'd have a shot. Many in the generation before mine believed that maybe they did, but they had the rug pulled out from under them by cuts in programs like the Pell Grants or by a myriad setbacks that came with the age of crack. Reversal spun them right back to the streets and away from their true ambitions. For the rest of us, those who snuck in despite coming from the margins, the mission has to be to pull up others behind us. That's what Paul White did for me, and it changed my life. I'd been talking with Mayor Schmoke for 10 minutes when he leaned towards me and asked the dreaded question. "So, Wes, what do you plan on doing after you finish school?" I really had no idea. The words, "law school," escaped from my mouth, the fallback answer for many students who have no idea what they want to do with their lives. Mayor Schmoke waved his hand at the idea. "Have you ever heard of the Rhodes Scholarship?" I had heard of it. I knew that Mayor Schmoke, President Clinton, and our state senior senator, Paul Sarbanes, were all Rhodes Scholars, but I didn't know much else about the award. "Let me show you something," the mayor continued, rising from his wooden seat and moving toward the wall. I followed him. He pulled out a pen and stretched his arm toward a black and white framed picture. Right there is James Atlas, a writer from The New Yorker. Over here, that's Frank Rains. He's the head of the Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton administration. His pen then moved a few inches over on the picture. And there I am. This is my Rhodes class. I stared at the photo of 80 young faces smiling into the camera. The plaid suits with large collars, the bushy mustaches and overdue haircuts, and the thick knotted ties were all obviously stylish back when he went to Oxford but looked a little funny through contemporary eyes. Then again, my high waters and medium-sized suit jacket didn't exactly qualify me as a fashion critic. I recognized a few other faces in the crowd and realized that, whether they were household names or not, this was an exclusive group that held a significant amount of influence and power. People who could engineer real change. Mirshmo continued to tell me about his experiences as I listened intently. He reminisced about the stimulating conversations that took place in rustic pubs over warm beer. He told me about living and working in buildings constructed hundreds of years before the United States was even founded. He shared with me some of the trips he took around Europe, and he told me about the odd feeling of being a minority, not because you were African American, but because you were an American in the wider world. After he completed his anecdotes, Mirshmoke ended our meeting. He extended his large, calloused hand, and before I could leave the office, he gave me one last order. Mirshmoke knew that weeks after I completed the internship with him, I would be heading to South Africa for a semester abroad. To him, this chance to see South Africa less than a decade after the end of apartheid was the perfect preparation for a real understanding of the Rhodes experience and legacy. In his thoughtful, deliberate cadence, he said, "While you're in South Africa, admire the beauty and culture, but make sure you do not leave without understanding the history. Make sure you understand who Cecil Rhodes was and what his legacy is. Know this before you apply for his scholarship." Not sure what to say, I simply said, "Yes, sir," my grip tightening in his hand. I thanked him for the opportunity to serve and began my walk through the archway leading me back into the waiting area. I found out years later that it was Judge Robert Hammerman and Senator Sarbanes who gave Mayor Schmoke the confidence to apply for the Rhodes Scholarship. I hoped that, in some way, Mayor Schmoke felt like he had returned the favor. Of course, he did more than just point me to the Rhodes Scholarship. He instructed me to learn the larger historical context of the award. Although I really didn't understand it at the time, like Colin Powell, he was telling me that our blood-soaked and atrocity-littered past was important, but that the future didn't have to be its slave. Even a legacy as ugly as that of Cecil Rhodes, a 19th-century imperialist, white supremacist, and rapacious businessman, could be turned around and used by a person like me, someone Cecil Rhodes would have undoubtedly despised, to change the world that Rhodes and people like him had left for us. I had traveled abroad before. I'd visited Jamaica often to see family when I was growing up. I also went to Cuba with a group of Johns Hopkins students to study the island's arts and culture, a trip I used to try to find my long-lost great-aunt and other family members. But this would be my first long-term trip abroad. The 15-hour flight would be just the beginning of a much larger journey. My January arrival was met with over 85-degree heat. Because South Africa is below the equator, their seasons are the reverse of ours. So I boarded the plane knowing that I would bypass the winter cold this year. I walked into John F. Kennedy International Airport with my sweater and oversized brown goose-down jacket, and I walked out into the Cape Town heat with just a t-shirt, shorts, and sunglasses shading my eyes. "Are you Wes?" a strongly accented voice shouted towards me. The pronunciation made my name sound like Wes. I immediately knew this would take some getting used to. The voice, an unfamiliar mixture of Australian and Dutch inflections, came from the tall and thin but muscular man now walking towards me in khaki shorts and a Bahama shirt. A pair of sunglasses rested on top of his balding head. "I am," I cautiously replied. He smiled and introduced himself as the director of the Study Abroad program. He said his name was Zed, which, he explained, was a nickname taken from his first initial, Z, which is pronounced Zed in much of the English-speaking world. I had never heard that before, but took his word for it. I felt a little disoriented by this smiling white Zimbabwean with an odd accent and strange name. I didn't know what I was expecting from my introduction to Africa, but it sure wasn't Zed. I'd applied for and received a grant to go to South Africa through the School for International Training, a Vermont-based program that offers a chance to live overseas for a semester or more. That semester, 14 of us left our respective corners of the United States and traveled to South Africa. We went to school together at the University of Cape Town and studied culture and reconciliation, a subject for which post-apartheid South Africa had become a living laboratory. Aside from the normal curriculum at the university, we would spend our time learning the language, learning the country, and learning more about ourselves than we ever imagined. I sat in the back of a spacious van, loaded down with bags and a group of confused and overwhelmed American students, staring out the window. I was dumbstruck by the natural beauty of the country. I could see the clouds rolling off Table Mountain and the crowds of wealthy South Africans casually peering into the pristine water at the V&A waterfront. I was impressed by the natural beauty, but I knew that Africa wasn't just a giant safari. My grandfather, who'd worked throughout Africa as a missionary, would often share the truth with me about the tremendous cultural diversity that lies within the continent. But I was in no way prepared for the massive skyscrapers, gorgeous beachside drives, and awesome monuments I saw on our initial trip in the country. This city could have been dropped onto any American coast and no one would have batted an eye. Or so it seemed, until we moved out of the downtown and into the townships where we will be living. Our van eventually exited the expressway at Langa, the oldest township in South Africa. The legacy of apartheid was glaringly obvious in South Africa's cities. The institution of a legal, government-sanctioned racial caste system was overturned in 1994 with the first democratic elections, but its effects still haunted the country. Government-supported racial segregation had given way to economically enforced segregation. And, given the significant overlap between race and class in South Africa, whites, coloreds, and blacks all still made their homes in different locations. Langa was established in 1923 as Cape Town's first black township. Similar to Khayelitsha, Guguletu, Kopanang, and other historic townships in South Africa, it was created for the sole purpose of isolating black Africans in small, destitute enclaves where laws were instituted to control the residents and police entered to harass, not to protect. When these townships were established, Afrikaners, or whites of Dutch ancestry, made up 9% of the population. Black Africans, who generally lived on only 5% of the nation's land, made up over 80% of the population. These were South Africa's projects, areas where despair and hopelessness were not accidental products of the environment, but rather the whole point. It was obviously a far more egregious situation, but I could sense faint echoes of Baltimore and the Bronx in the story of these townships. The van bounced steadily up and down as the shocks attempted to adjust to the transition from the paved multi-lane highways to the pothole-laden, dirt-covered streets of the township. Kids, dozens of them, lined every street we drove down, staring at the vehicle as we cautiously cruised by them. Their smiles were bright, and they gave us thumbs up as we rolled past them, as if they had known us from somewhere else, which just reinforced my disorienting feeling of familiarity. A few minutes after entering Langa, we stopped in front of an understated white house in the middle of Mchipela Street. Zed looked over his shoulder from the driver's seat and shared another gigantic smile. "Wes, this is your stop." I stepped out of the van and walked to the back to pull out my one overstuffed bag, my entire wardrobe for half a year crammed into a 40-pound Samsonite. My white Nikes kicked up dust as I made the short walk from the van to the front of the house. This would be my home for the next 6 months. A short distance to my left, I saw a vertigo-inducing sea of shacks, rolling out as far as the eye could see. The walls of these houses were patchworks of wood or aluminum or metal or whatever scraps were lying around. Spare pieces of metal were propped up as roofs, and pieces of torn cloth were hung as curtains. These shelters were lined up in a sort of organized chaos. They seemed improvised and temporary, but they'd been there for years. Well, some of them, at least. I would later find out that every few months or so, the fires that burned in makeshift stoves would flare out of control, jumping from one tightly packed shack to another and burning out a whole section of the shantytown before they were extinguished. A week later, all the shacks would be rebuilt, and it would be business as usual. As I moved closer to the home where my host family lived, I couldn't stop staring at the shantytown. Living in the Bronx and Baltimore had given me the foolish impression that I knew what poverty looked like. At that moment, I realized I had no idea what poverty was. Even in West Baltimore, we live like kings compared with this. An embarrassing sense of pride tentatively bloomed in the middle of the sadness I felt at my surroundings. I was 5 feet away from the door covered in peeling white paint when it creaked open. A short, rotund woman with cropped and curled hair, beautifully clear, dark skin, and a radiant smile walked out. She was wearing a dress that reminded me of the West African-inspired kente cloth attire I'd seen in the States, but hers was an intricately meshed pattern of black and white, the traditional Xhosa colors. Xhosa was her tribe, and Langa was a mainly Xhosa township. It was also the tribe of Nelson Mandela, Govan Mbeki, and many other heroes of the African National Congress. I smiled and extended my hand to introduce myself, and was immediately wrapped up in her arms. She hugged me, as if I was a family member she had not seen in years. "Molo!" she exclaimed into my ear as our cheeks pushed against each other, the Xhosa word for hello. Her affection was infectious, and I squeezed her right back. When she let go, I noticed her children standing behind her, a son named Zinzi, who was a few years younger than me, and a daughter named Viwe, who was 8 years old, waiting to welcome me to their home. Zinzi moved towards me, his short, dreadlock hair spiked up on top of his head. "Hey, Buti, how's the flight?" he said in a deep baritone voice. Buti, the Xhosa word for brother, was not used loosely. The family went out of their way to make me feel welcomed, at home. Viwe was a sightly but shy girl who stayed close to her mother's hip as she gave me a quick hug. I imagined how odd an experience it must have been for her having this American enter her small home to live. She knew nothing about me. In retrospect, I guess I did know how she felt. I felt much the same way. The week after I arrived, I walked into the kitchen to find only Mama sitting there. She was making herself some tea and asked me to join her. I sat down at the small wooden table next to the stove, the shaky tabletop stabilized by pieces of cardboard stuck under the legs. This was where most of the family meals were eaten. She poured the boiling hot water into mugs with tea bags already placed inside and brought our two cups over. "So, tell me more about yourself," she began. "I have been spending so much time with my homestay brother, Zinzi, his friend Simo, and the other Americans I'd come with, and attending our classes at the university, that I had not had a chance to really speak with her yet." Our tea turned into a 3-hour marathon of stories about our lives, fears, and dreams. She explained to me the color dynamic in South Africa, how there I would be considered colored because I was not dark enough to be considered black. Colored was a concept created during the apartheid era to further isolate the races. Coloreds received more privileges than blacks did. Not many more, but enough to seed antagonism between the two groups. The lighter your skin was in apartheid South Africa, the better off you were. I learned about the music of the apartheid era, and how it was the musicians and artists, even more than the politicians and activists, who informed the world about the country's injustices. I also learned about Ubuntu, the Xhosa word for humanity, and the power of authentic leadership, as exhibited by giants like Nelson Mandela and 1,000 other self-sacrificing visionaries who had managed the unforeseen transition from apartheid to democracy without a bloodbath. On our third cup of tea, Mama began to tell me about her husband and his role as a freedom fighter during apartheid. She told me about how he and his fellow soldiers were intimidated, arrested, and beaten for failing to comply with government rules about carrying personal identification cards. I listened in amazement and horror as, through trembling lips, she talked about the hopelessness people felt during this time and the pain of knowing that this level of segregation, this level of poverty, this level of depression was being imposed on a people for things that they were in no way responsible for or should be ashamed of. Finally, I had to stop her. "Mama, I am sorry to disturb you, but I am very confused. After all this pain and heartache, how are you now able to forgive? You seem so at peace with yourself and your life. How are you so able to move on?" She gave me an easy half smile and took another sip from her mug. "Because Mr. Mandela asked us to." I'd expected more. I'd expected her to tell me she was still working on her revenge scheme, or that she was afraid their weapons were too strong so there was no use in fighting. But her simple and profound answer helped me to understand that Ubuntu was not simply a word. It was a way of life. Her candor and exquisite simplicity framed the rest of my trip and helped me better understand the land I was living in. It also helped me complete a thought that had begun that night with my father and developed through my training and education and my time with Mayor Schmoke in Baltimore. The common bond of humanity and decency that we share is stronger than any conflict, any adversity, any challenge. Fighting for your convictions is important, but finding peace is paramount. Knowing when to fight and when to seek peace is wisdom. Ubuntu was right, and so was my father. Watende, my middle name, all at once made perfect sense. A few days later, I finally had a chance to talk to my mother on the phone. I was excited to share all of my experiences, and she, having never been to South Africa, was excited to hear my detailed descriptions. She updated me on how everything was going back home, and then shared a piece of strange local news. "Everything is fine, but I have something crazy to tell you. Did you know that the cops are looking for another guy from your neighborhood with your name for killing a cop?" A few weeks before I was set to leave South Africa and return to the States, I was walking with Zinzi and Simo from the Kumbi, or bus station, back to the house. The once overwhelming sensory overload of township life now seemed second nature to me. Kwaito, a South African mix of hip-hop and house music, blared from cars that passed us. Children kicked soccer balls back and forth on the dirt-covered road, with large rocks serving as goalposts. Women spoke loudly to one another while carrying bags in their arms and on their heads. The sound of the quick, click-ridden Xhosa language was everywhere. I was beginning to understand the language and the feel of the street life. My stride through the Langa streets was slower and less frantic than it had been. I was finally feeling at home. My friendship with Zinzi and Simo had also grown significantly. Every day after class, we would walk around the neighborhoods, talking to girls on the university campus, going to Mama Africa restaurants to grab one of the best steaks I've ever tasted, or watching cricket at a local watering hole. All of this felt particularly sweet in these last days, as the nostalgia that kicks in at the end of any meaningful experience had started to affect us. Simo looked up at us and said, "So both of you all are leaving soon. What am I supposed to do then?" Both Zinzi and I were about to embark on journeys. I would soon be heading back to the United States, where, in a matter of months, I would be accepting my degree from the president of Johns Hopkins, William Brody, who had become a cherished mentor and friend. Despite entering the school with lower scores than the average student, I would walk across the stage as a Phi Beta Kappa graduate who was also the first Rhodes Scholar in 13 years at Johns Hopkins and the first African-American Rhodes Scholar in school history. Zinzi, now 17 years old, was preparing to take the same path as generations of Xhosa boys before him. He would be leaving soon to spend 4 weeks in the bush, where he and dozens of other boys would join an aggregate of elders and learn what it means to be a Xhosa man. Within days of arriving, the young men would be circumcised, their foreskins removed, like childish cloaks now deemed unnecessary. During the weeks it takes the circumcision to heal, they would learn about the history of the tribe, the battles they'd fought, the land they protected, the leaders they'd created. They would learn about what it means to be a good father and a good husband. The boys would meditate and pray together, eat together, and heal together. They would return to their homes as heroes. A large feast would be cooked for them. They would wear all white for the month after returning, symbolizing that a boy had left, but a man had returned. They would be spoken to differently, viewed differently. I asked Zinzi if he was scared. "Not really, man. We all have to go through it. Besides, I saw my older brother went through it and how much respect he got. It will be fine." "Yeah, but I can't imagine the whole circumcision thing without any drugs, man. Way too painful if you ask me." Simo smirked at the thought of it while shaking his head. Zinzi laughed and said, "I hear you, but it's not the process you should focus on. It's the joy you will feel after you go through the process." We walked through the small alley that separated the main road from Mshapela Street. Our conversation strayed back to sports and gossip, but as we passed through the alley, I was struck by the sight of a young man, splendid in an all-white outfit, from his shoes to his wide-brimmed hat. He appeared barely pubescent, but was walking with the dignity of a man double his age. Because of Zinzi, I knew exactly what that man had gone through and the pride and admiration his family now shared about his accomplishment. My head turned, and I stared at the young man. His bright eyes and straight back demanded attention. The confidence in his stride was something that Zinzi did not yet have, something that Simo did not yet have, something that I did not yet have. And again, I thought of home. I realized just how similar were the challenges the young boys here and kids like the ones I grew up with faced. In both places, young men go through a daily struggle, trying to navigate their way through deadly streets, poverty, and the twin legacies of exclusion and low expectations. But they are not completely unequipped. They also have the history of determined, improvisational survival, a legacy of generations who fought through even more oppressive circumstances. One of the key differences between the two was in the way the community saw them. Here, burgeoning manhood was guided and celebrated through a rite of passage. At home, burgeoning manhood was a trigger for apprehension. In the United States, we see these same faces, and our reflex is to pick up our pace and cross the street. And in this reflexive gesture, the dimensions of our tragedy are laid bare. Our young men, along with our young women, are our strength and our future. Yet we fear them. This tall South African, who now captured my attention, wore his manhood as a sign of accomplishment, a badge of honor. His process was a journey taken with his peers, guided by his elders, and completed in a celebration. He was now a man. His community welcomed him. His tribe's influence in making him a man was obvious and indelible. At that moment, I realized the journey I took was never mine alone either. Our eyes met, and he smiled and nodded his head. I nodded my head in return. Epilogue. Wes has spent every day of his life since 2000 in the Jessup Correctional Institution, a maximum security facility in Maryland. His day begins at 5:30 a.m. He works as a carpenter, making desks and tables, and sometimes he makes license plates. He gets paid about 53 cents a day, which he can use at the prison commissary to buy toothpaste, snacks, stamps, and other miscellaneous items. Lights go out at 10 p.m. Guards tell him when to wake up, when to eat, when to go to the bathroom. He has 2 hours of free time a day, outside time, that he can use to play basketball or talk to other inmates. Wes is now a devout Muslim. Initially, he went to Friday mosque services because they were the only opportunity he had to see his brother Tony, who was also in Jessup. But eventually he started to pay attention to the message and decided to learn more. He is now a leader in the significant Muslim community in the Jessup prison. Wes's family still visits him occasionally, but the visits are not easy on Wes. He is exhaustively searched before being let into the visitor's area. The joy he feels when he is sitting across from a loved one quickly dissipates at the end of the visit as he walks back through the gate to his cell. It hurts him that he has no control over what is happening with his family on the outside. He has stopped answering questions like, "How are you doing?" His answer doesn't change. His days don't change. When he gets visitors, he mainly sits and listens. In 2008, Wes and many of his fellow inmates followed the presidential election closely, hoping for the election of the first black president in American history. The inmates celebrated when Barack Obama won, but their enthusiasm faded quickly. Wes and the other lifers realized that no matter who the president was, their fate was sealed. At the time of this book's writing, Wes has just become a grandfather. He is serving the 10th year of a life sentence. He is 33 years old. Here's what some of the other characters in the story have been up to since 2000. My mother retired from her job with a foundation for disadvantaged children, where she managed communications for grantees. She is now running her own consultancy focused on helping foundations use film and media to tell their stories. She works in Baltimore and lives just outside the city. She says she enjoys the slower pace and quiet. She remains the rock of our family. My sisters are both doing very well. Nikki runs her own event planning business in Virginia. Shani graduated from Princeton University in 2001, after which she attended Stanford Law School on a full scholarship. She and her husband live in Los Angeles. Uncle Howard has remained a mentor and guide in my life and was the co-best man, along with Justin, at my wedding. He lives in southern New Jersey with my Aunt Pam and their two daughters. Despite having a difficult time with the death of his mother, Justin managed to finish high school strong and received a scholarship to college. While he was in his senior year of college, his father passed away in a house fire, and Justin himself battled and beat a rare form of cancer. Since graduating from college, he has worked in education and now serves as dean at a prestigious high school outside Philadelphia. He has devoted his professional life to addressing the educational disparities in this country. Captain Ty Hill graduated from Valley Forge Military College and earned the rank of second lieutenant in the United States Army Reserve. He served in the Army as an officer from 1992 to 1999 and has worked as a corporate lawyer since. He was a groomsman at my wedding and remains a cherished friend and mentor. He lives in New York and still intimidates the hell out of me. My grandfather passed away from complications of stomach cancer in 2005. Despite the best efforts of my chain of command to get me back to the Bronx from Afghanistan, I could not get there in time to say goodbye. Fortunately, I was able to be home for his funeral and was one of hundreds who were there to pay their respects and let him know how much he meant to us as he was laid to rest. My grandmother still lives in the same home in the Bronx, presiding as ever as the family matriarch. She is in her 80s and still watches over her family like a lioness protecting her pride. She still makes a mean batch of codfish whenever we come over. Wes's mother, Mary, works in medical technology, specializing in elder care. She is raising six children, three of Wes's kids, her niece, her nephew, and her youngest son. She lives in Aberdeen, Maryland, a little under an hour away from Baltimore City. Wes's aunt Niecy has been working for the state of Maryland doing home visits for the elderly, sick, and shut in for a decade. Her children live in Maryland and Pennsylvania, and her youngest just graduated from high school. All of her children finished high school. Wes's brother, Tony, was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole after he was convicted as a trigger man in the death of Sergeant Prothero. The death penalty was taken off the table after Tony agreed to cooperate with the state. Sergeant Prothero's sister told Tony as he was leaving the courthouse after sentencing that Bruce stood for everything that was good in society, and you stand for everything that is evil. Never remorseful, Tony coolly replied, "Same to you." In March 2008, Tony died in prison from kidney failure. He was 38 years old. Wes's best friend, Woody, spent many of his years after high school going in and out of prison. When the second of his three children was born, his sister had a stern talk with him about getting a legitimate job so he could watch his kids grow up. She helped him get work as a truck driver in Baltimore, a job he holds to this day. Now in his mid-30s, Woody lives in West Baltimore and has three children. White boy dropped out of high school to be a waiter. He lives just outside Atlanta, where he works for a magazine running the printing press. Woody was the best man at his wedding. Alicia is currently raising only one of her two children with Wes. She works security for the Transportation Security Administration at a Maryland airport and lives in Aberdeen, close to Wes's mother. Cheryl battled drug addiction for years and eventually lost custody of her two children with Wes. In 2002, she fell down a flight of stairs and was paralyzed. She died soon after from complications of the injuries. She was 24 years old. As for me, after receiving the Rhodes Scholarship, I spent 2.5 years completing my master's in international relations at Oxford. It was as revelatory, exciting, intense, and surreal as Mayor Schmoak promised. My time at Oxford began immediately after the attacks of September 11, 2001, which further heightened my sensitivity to being an American abroad, but also helped me get a better understanding of the international reaction to those searing events. When I returned to the States, I interned in Washington, D.C., focusing on homeland security issues. But many of my mentors told me that if I really wanted to understand the changes going on in American and international policy, I needed to understand the global economic system. So after completing my graduate degree, I joined the world of high finance on Wall Street. While I was working there, two American wars raged on. The young men and women who were headed to Iraq and Afghanistan to serve and fight weren't just anonymous recruits, but friends of mine, brothers and sisters in arms. I spoke with a mentor and great friend, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Fenzel, who had just been named Deputy Brigade Commander of the hallowed 1st Brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division. The 82nd was preparing to depart for Afghanistan for a year-long